I'm Judith Brown, and we're old friends, as you know. And just for listeners that don't know me, I worked in the Middle East in Lebanon and Yemen for a number of years, and fell in love with the Middle East. But when I was there, I really felt that what I was seeing with my own eyes was very different to what I expected to see. And I decided that I would, when I came back, do a PhD looking into why this difference, looking into the British media and how it's what influenced the imagery that appeared in the British media. And from then on, I joined an Arab organisation in London that analysed newspapers, which is closed now. And then I think that was when I was first on your show. So that was quite a number of years ago, 20 years or more. And then I carried on doing various bits of research. But since the COVID issue in 2020, I've really been concentrating on censorship, which, you know, media and how it selects stories, what influences the media, has been sort of like the background of my research. And I've looked a lot into propaganda and censorship over the last 20 years. But I've really been concentrating on censorship. I did something on the regulatory, media regulatory authorities in UK, and something on the Online Harms Act. I think they call it the Online Safety Act. And now I've been doing for maybe 2 years something on the fact-checking network, which has actually had some sort of like dramatic changes in America, not so much in Europe recently. So we're at very interesting times. I'm still in contact with people from Yemen, and I hear from Yemen quite regularly. It's in a very sad state. And I'm in contact with people that worked in Lebanon with me. So I keep an eye on the Middle East, and I'm very saddened at the whole situation there at the moment.
No, I mean, a lot of people are holding out some hope for this ceasefire deal. Maybe you could just start, Judith, by explaining what it was about the Middle East that you fell in love with. Because it's interesting, isn't it, that you go somewhere, you're being told is a hotbed of war, of terrorism, and you turn up and you fall in love with the place. How did you do that?
Well, I think that it was the people. They were so warm and so friendly. They welcomed me into their lives. They made me feel really as if I was really important. They were extremely hospitable. I hardly ever had a day when I wasn't invited out to eat with some family somewhere. Of course, the history was fascinating. You're actually looking at historic sites because, of course, it was the beginning of civilization there. I learned a lot about Yemen, which, along with China, is one of the two oldest countries in the world that have operated within more or less the same boundaries, with more or less the same language and more or less the same people for thousands of years. And that was quite interesting. I didn't know anything about that. So it was just the sort of like the whole sort of like culture, but particularly the people. They were so, like, for example, despite the British occupation in Yemen, they would say, oh, we love British people, and be, you know, they didn't, when you looked at the war graves in Aden, they were beautifully kept, the British, the graves of the British occupiers. The churches were looked after in Aden. In fact, after the war in 1990, I think it was, some of the churches were destroyed, but the Yemeni people actually repaired them and made them as good as new. The statue of Queen Victoria was there in Aden. They seemed to sort of like be so tolerant and so respectful of both people within their community.
This is something that people don't understand necessarily about Yemen, is in the 1960s when the British were kicked out, the British occupiers were kicked out, we left quite quickly. There were very few deaths. I think it was maybe 50 people or something on the British side of the soldiers. Very few British soldiers were killed because we weren't really resisting that. I think most of the Brits in the 1960s realised the age of empire was over, so we didn't make a big deal about it. Most of the Brits just got on a plane and left.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that there was a feeling that they would still retain their Air Force base there and maybe their shipping port, and that had employed a lot of people. But I think that the South Yemen government, as it was then, was quite happy to accommodate that. But the British decided that they would leave their bases as well as not actually occupying. So I think that I think that there was a lot of communications between the Yemeni people. There were two groups that were fighting for control after the British left, and I think most of the antagonism was between those two groups. But relating to the British, I think that, as you say, they realised that their time had come to leave Yemenis to self-rule, and away they went. And of course, Lebanon also has a very interesting history, close to the Holy Land. I lived in a Palestinian refugee camp, which was quite fascinating. I was the only British person living in a camp of 27,000 Palestinians at one point, although later two other women came and joined me. So I was very integrated into their society and never felt that I was a threat. I think the quite interesting thing was, though, that I went there just after the fall of the Soviet Union, and I think that one thing that I could see was that the educational opportunities had been quite significant for Palestinians living in Lebanon whilst the Soviet Union was viable and was going, because they all were able to go to different Eastern European countries and get further education. You know, there were the doctors, for example, all had got degrees from Romania, from Russia, from Czechoslovakia and whatever. And as soon as the Soviet Union fell, that avenue of further education disappeared, and I felt that it was a time when the Palestinians had in Lebanon had no hope. There was no hope for the future because they were really forgotten and kept in camps by the Lebanese government, and I felt that it was only a matter of time before people who have no future will eventually sort of like try to break out. And of course, it was not long after that the extremist group started developing in Palestinian society, which really demonstrates that when people have no hope, they turn to terrorism, and maybe that's a lesson for us all at this moment in time.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be. Anyway, we've now got this digital rights bill being threatened by the new emperor. I just call him an emperor now. Trump about to start. And I know you've been looking at not just the control of information, but also this whole fact-checking industry. Can you take us through the fact-checkers? Who funds them? Who's behind this? And do you think it's a good idea that Zuckerberg is now saying he wants them out of Facebook?
Well, I think that I've certainly been a victim of fact-checking and censorship myself on social media, because anything that was challenging censorship was censored. And some time ago, I was told that my posts would go nowhere, and I stopped using Facebook because I think that everything that I posted just stayed on my own Facebook page. So they obviously didn't want anyone to know anything about censorship. So I think that somebody, I gave an interview on TNT radio, and they put it onto YouTube, and it was banned there. And they said that's the first time they'd had anybody censored from TNT this particular TNT radio program on YouTube. So obviously, calling out censors is restricting, and it's meant that it's been difficult to get people to be aware of my research. And for you, Tony, I thank you because you've allowed me a few interviews on this. But so I was part of an academic group called Panda, and I was in the media analysis group. In fact, I still am, but I'm not very active there now. And decided that I would, together with my supervisor, Piers Robinson, we decided that it would be quite a good idea to look at fact check platforms. And I thought it would be a couple of months looking at what was happening. I didn't think it would be a very big thing, but it turned out that it's just enormous. There are hundreds of fact check platforms all over the world, all funded by Western interests, largely. The funding that comes from local sources is very minimal. And the funders are the immensely wealthy who have these, foundations. They call them humanitarian, but really, most of them, they're just a means of avoiding tax and putting their money into political causes. And also governments. I mean, the EU, for example, was a very big funder. And through the Twitter files, we know that in spite of the First Amendment in America, the Biden government was very heavily censoring Facebook. And Twitter and all other forms of social media, and was funding this through various organizations, like the GEC, I've forgotten what it means in America, but it was a group through which they were, in America, through which they were funding a lot of the fact checking. So the censorship was really extreme. The Overton window through which you could debate was getting narrower and narrower. But the other strange thing was that from time to time they allowed a debate in. I think that you suffered from this, Tony, at the beginning, when you were on the BFCM radio. You mentioned the fact that the COVID virus may have come from a laboratory, the Wuhan lab, and that it may have been a manipulated virus made to be more contagious. And you were thrown off BFCM for saying that. But later on, maybe a year or two later, it became okay to discuss the fact that this may be...
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, this aspect of it all, because, I mean, we reported, it was the first show in February in 2020. We were just literally reporting a paper from India, the New Delhi Institute of Virology, where they've got a whole load of professors and virology students together to brainstorm this genome that had been released by the Chinese, which just showed you, you know, all of the DNA of this virus. And they immediately said, well, this looks unlikely to have occurred naturally. So they were saying that there were specific parts of that virus which looked as if they'd been spliced in. I mean, we weren't saying where it came from. It may have come from Wuhan. It may have come from Fort Detrick. It may have come from Porton Down. But the fact was that right early on in all of this, just literally as it was starting, this report, which was put out by Zero Hedge, and the next couple of days, Zero Hedge had their Twitter account closed. So we were reporting this stuff right at the very beginning. And it's like, you know, somebody's keeping a very close eye on what's coming out and squashing the truth.
Absolutely. In fact, you were reporting something that was factual. You weren't reporting something that wasn't factual. And I think that you told me that... and this fits in with Ofcom's position. I think you told me that the person who was running BFCM radio in Bristol told you that if they didn't close down your show, then they might be closed down by Ofcom. And in fact, that totally...
Well, yeah, that was over a separate, just to clarify, that was over a separate thing. Obviously, we were in a box marked trouble at this point, you know, so they're looking for any excuse to get rid of us. That was over a complaint by UK Lawyers for Israel to Ofcom about the show, saying that we were anti-Semitic. Well, actually, we had, funnily enough, just by some mad coincidence, I'd been going through getting on all of the Israeli cabinet ministers onto the programme, getting clips from them speaking. And so really this was a completely spurious complaint. But the manager was really very risk averse. He didn't like the idea that there might be Ofcom complaints because he might lose his licence and his income, which, you know, he's obviously getting quite a bit from and kudos from the controlling the radio station. So we stayed on at that point for a little while, but it was the COVID. He took everybody off air, and I never heard from him again. You know, he didn't want us back, obviously.
Yeah, I know it's that. Well, of course, the Israeli lobby is very, very powerful, and certainly the mainstream media has a lot of influence from the pro-Israeli lobby. It's quite interesting. I read a book very recently by Ellen Pappy called The Lobby Both Sides of the Atlantic, and you can see it's sort of its tentacles there. How, you know, for well over 100 years, it's been sort of controlling government activities. I'm not necessarily saying Israel, and I'm not necessarily saying Jews, but the pro-Zionist lobby, which of course initially was largely a Christian Zionist movement, rather than a Jewish movement. But they've been, they're still active now and still looking very much at the Israeli case. I was quite interested to see the statement by our dear Prime Minister Keir Starmer recently. I think he put it out yesterday, saying that, you know, thank goodness for the ceasefire, and it just took a totally pro-Israeli case. He said it began on the 7th of October. Well, of course, we all know that it began 75 years ago when they've been ethnically cleansing of 17 years Gaza had been under siege. And there was going to be a sort of, it's some desperate action, in order to try to sort of like change the situation for Palestinians. I think it has changed the situation in as much as it's made it a lot worse for Palestinians. But in Starmer's statement, of course, he doesn't suggest that, he says there's been, you know, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians killed or many Palestinian lives lost. But he doesn't say that this has been considered a genocide by lots of organizations. It's been considered by the International Court of Justice and all of the human rights organizations and lots of academics that look into genocide. have all said that this is a clear case of genocide, and yet that wasn't mentioned in Starmer's statement at all. And then he's saying, now we hope that Palestinians will have a much better future. What, in a land that where hospitals have all been destroyed, schools have all been destroyed, universities have all been destroyed, 80% at least of housing has been destroyed. What better future is there going to be? So you can see that it's not just the media, but it's also politicians. Interesting, though, that Trump, I do have some hope for the Trump administration, that some ministers in Israel are saying that they wouldn't have agreed the ceasefire but for the fact that Trump insisted on it. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, look, I mean, David Miller, he's now fighting again through the courts.
Yeah,
Bristol University have decided that they want to overturn the judge's decision in the employment tribunal that he was wrongfully dismissed. He's managed to establish this precedent that anti-Zionism is a protected characteristic and that you cannot sack someone from being anti-Zionist, which he most definitely is. But he's pointing out that the policies to do with what they call preventing radicalization of Muslims policies in both the UK, the EU, Holland, France, Spain and Italy were all introduced in a sort of long stream. He's also pointing out that there are a whole load of journalists and journalistic organizations in his latest report who were all supportive of Israel suddenly started appearing on the scene. He goes through a whole list of the Murdoch Empire, where Michael Gove, Danny Finkelstein, David Aronovich, Oliver Kam, Hugo Rifkind, these were all appointed as pro-Zionist columnists, etc., by Rupert Murdoch. And this is a systematic attempt to make the entire mainstream press pro-Israel before the genocide. So what it does make you wonder, Judith, is if this is all very much to plan. It's a huge conspiracy and premeditated.
Absolutely. And if you, I mean, there's going to be a demonstration in London this weekend, which was going to protest at Rafi Berg being...
That's right, on Saturday, yeah.
In charge of the BBC's Middle East coverage. And, of course, he's an ardent Zionist. But the police have actually decided that they're going to... stop people going near to the BBC. And also, really bizarrely, because I've been on marches in London a few times myself, and what I've found is that they're always incredibly peaceful. I mean, once when I was there, this was towards the beginning, there were some people saying that their family members were held in the hostages. And actually the people from the march were actually going up to them and saying, we're really sorry, we hope that they will be freed soon. And they were really friendly towards them, which meant that, I don't know whether that was meant they were meaning to be political, but it sort of backfired. And I don't think that they've been there recently, because obviously they were getting so much sympathy from the Palestinian marchers. And there's never been any attacks on Jews. There's never been, in fact, Jews are always part of the protest. There's always a Jewish section in the protest. So they've also said that they want to go near to a synagogue. Well, I think 600 Jews, including some from that synagogue, have actually said to the police that there's no reason to protect the synagogue because it's never been attacked by Palestinian activists. So it's a very strange situation that the police now are sort of acting to A, protect the BBC, and B, to fit in with the propaganda campaign that Palestinian activists are dangerous in some way.
Yeah, they they like to call them hate marches. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, and this often goes unchallenged in the mainstream press, in places like The Guardian now. I mean, we've got an article which has just been published in the last week about the fact checkers and Meta and Zuckerberg's announcement that at Facebook that they won't, that they'll be withdrawing this fact checkers. It's by a guy called Chris Stokel Walker. A new era of lies, he says. Mark Zuckerberg has just ushered in an extinction-level event for truth on social media. Now, I mean, as a journalist, I look at this and I think, truth, you shouldn't really be saying... I mean, obviously, all journalists want to get to the truth, but the idea that these fact-checkers are there just simply to tell you the truth and to get rid of the lies... I mean, journalists used to do this in the old days. This was our job, and we knew that if we did put out a horrific lie that started a war, like something about weapons of mass destruction, for example, being in Iraq, that we would lose our jobs. And something very strange happened back in 2003, and that was that the people that did tell the truth about the lack of weapons of mass destruction, Andrew Gilligan on the Today programme and Greg Dyke, who was the director general of the BBC, who backed him, were both sacked. So there's a very perverse sort of idea here that the truth is actually, it's very Orwellian. But anyway, what do you make of people like this chap in The Guardian, Chris Stokel Walker? Is he saying the Meta chief executive has found himself in the past 21 years a central part of our society? Initially, he oversaw a website that was used by college students. Now it's used by billions. He's also saying that social networks have always struggled to moderate speech on their platforms. The one thing they are certain of doing, whichever way they've come down on an argument, is annoying 50% of the population. These platforms haven't helped themselves with chronic underinvestment in favour of growing their business at all costs. So these are the sorts of sentiments. He's saying basically that this whole idea of getting rid of fact checkers is a total and utter disaster, Judith.
Well, I mean, The Guardian is funded by Bill and Melinda Gates, say no more. So their foundation is one of the funders of The Guardian, and they wouldn't be able to exist but for the funding by the immensely wealthy. And ever since they've resorted to taking money from the immensely wealthy, The Guardian has got more and more pro the narrative. And of course the fact checkers don't fact check against for the truth, they fact check against a narrative, a particular style of speaking that is approved by governments and the funders of the fact check platforms. And so censorship is, I mean, a lot of people who don't speak out of turn and sort of, you know, just always think that the government is acting in their best interests, probably are unaware of censorship. But I can't imagine that anybody who works for a newspaper is unaware of censorship. I mean, many of the newspapers and television companies actually were registered with the International Fact Checking Network, the IFCN in America, which meant that they had to keep to a certain ways of fact checking, and they all operate with the same, exactly the same system. They gave out grants, for example, for people who for fact checkers to check stories related to climate, stories related to gender, stories related to COVID, stories related to vaccines in general. There were grants given out by the IFCN. And the IFCN, of course, was and is funded by the immensely wealthy and Google. I mean, quite interesting, all of the funding that comes from the American government is going to be stopped, according to Trump. So they'll be losing income from Meta and also losing money from governments. And it'll be quite interesting whether the immensely wealthy step up to fill that funding gap. But I think that, you know, for example, Elon Musk, who has given up fact-checking when he took over Twitter, he's run into sort of like various problems. He withdrew from Brazil for a time, but then he agreed to pay a $5 million fine and to start moderating his content in Brazil in order to get back onto into the Brazilian market. And similarly, he's being investigated by the EU for offending the Digital Services Act, which is the same as our Online Safety Act in UK.
I feel like we're almost being sucked into this kind of spiral of these people trying to self-regulate what they write. I mean, back when I was doing mainstream journalism, you know, having millions of people listening to what we were saying and doing, obviously, you know, you're checking yourself. You're almost like pinching yourself before you go in front of a microphone or you type a script out for a presenter. And in those days, the only real criteria was we must have a balance. We'll try and make sure that all the different main views on this are expressed. And the other thing was to do with criminality. So you wouldn't be allowing someone to say something which was encouraging crime. You know, this should be surely a matter for the police. You know, the idea is if you're trying to get someone to commit a crime, then the police are going to come after you rather than the journalists and the editors.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is exactly how it should be. And I think this is, if you look at the community notes, there aren't any community notes on Facebook or on Meta yet, but I suspect that they'll be very similar to the ones on X. But if you look at the community notes on X, that's virtually what they're saying, that you shouldn't incite violence, you shouldn't support groups that are incite violence, and in that I think X has been quite broad because it has actually excluded some Palestinian some posts that have been supportive of Palestinians, saying that so there has been some censorship of pro-Palestinian views on X, and I suspect that that will continue on Facebook. It's quite interesting that the head of Meta's headquarters are in Dublin now, worldwide headquarters, because they've got big tax concessions, so every sort of large online platform seems to operate out of Ireland, including Meta. And a spokesman for Meta is talking with the EU at the moment in Dublin about the way that they can comply with the Digital Services Act, because the Digital Services Act, which actually in some ways is more extreme than the Online Safety Act, in as much as the penalties for non-compliance are larger than the Online Safety Act. But I suspect that they'll have to do some sort of content moderation. The biggest market for social media platforms is Europe. And so therefore, what I find it difficult to get my head around is, can they actually operate two systems of content moderation, one for the USA and one for Europe? Now, if they can't, given that Europe is the biggest platform and there are going to be huge financial implications, things like 7% of their global income, not their profit, 7% of their global income can be fined up to that amount for not complying with the Online Safety Act or the DSA. So I think that you've got a position where the censorship is going to have to continue in Europe to some extent. There may be some opening of areas where they'll allow two sides of a debate, but I suspect that will still be a lot of restraints. And so we're at quite an interesting point at this moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might be that the best thing to do is to just get all these fact checkers to go home, really, because it seems to me better to allow the police to do this. So, yes. For example, if you're committing a crime, Meta and all the other major social media people, including the platforms such as Google, Apple, etc., they are facilitating surveillance of children and minors, and also they're facilitating the surveillance of the population as a whole under the mass surveillance of the National Security Agency and GCHQ. So that is a crime. You know, these are the sorts of things. This is why it seems to me, and it's one that is being ignored. You know, whereas much of the as Kevin Carhill has been doing some terrific work in unearthing this and saying, well, you know, you're not allowed to put people under surveillance without going to court first to get a warrant to do it, and you're certainly not allowed to put kids under surveillance, which you're doing. So it seems to me that the whole thing has gone completely into the pockets of the social media firms and the intelligence services, which is something that the police should be doing, and they're simply not.
And of course, Google is part of the CIA. I mean, it was founded by the CIA as, first of all, as a military intelligence, and then sort of opened up to other ordinary people in the world. So Google isn't likely to stop censoring, and they of course own YouTube. So you're going to get certain areas where the censorship is going to remain just as severe. But I think that it'd be quite interesting, because if Facebook and X are going to have to censor in order to satisfy their European market, will they run a different system that's more open in America? That might be quite difficult to do. And I think that I did read somewhere, well, in fact, I did, and I can't remember where I read it now. But the reason NATO is very, very closely tied to the EU, and in fact, NATO and the EU do run sort of joint fact-checking services. The EU funds Stratcom in Estonia, which has got us a big fact-check platform. And in fact, purposely, they wanted the Europe to legislate in order to control information, because they knew that if the EU legislated, then it would be very difficult for social media platforms to operate different systems in different parts of the world, given that the EU is their biggest market. So it'd be it is quite interesting to see how that will work out in the future. Of course, not only in the EU, but we've got our own Stratcom now in Cheshire, I think it is. And so no doubt the UK government is working with Stratcom, as indeed it works with the 77th Brigade controlling information. They run fact checking from GCHQ, in which they say that is just to I think that since the CDU has been implicated in censorship and not allowing voices like, for example, David Davis MP on social media. The CDU, which has changed its name now, and it says that it's only fact checking for foreign information. But of course, the thing is, they can say that if, for example, people are critical of the war in Ukraine, for example, just to give an example, then they can say that even if British people post to say that they don't like the war in Ukraine, they can say that this is Russian misinformation, for example. So you're not quite sure how the lines will be drawn. And I mean, my world experience of living nearly 80 years, I think for the first half of that, I was completely captured by by governments and believed that what I read in the media was actually the news, the most important things that were happening of that day. And it took me time to realize that it's propaganda, but for sort of half of my life, I've been aware that...
Well, look, I would challenge what you're saying there, Judith, because in my experience, things really did change in the 1990s.
Yep.
You know, there was enormous changes, actually, in the newsroom I was working in. In 1990 itself, we had some very peculiar people coming in who were pro-Zionist, putting into, put straight out of the outside world, in the music industry, marketing and advertising. Suddenly they're a senior producer. This was all under John Burt, the director general of the BBC. And I think what I actually witnessed, it's bizarre to have been there at this time, a complete change, in attitude in the early 90s, from, the sort of things I was saying, where we want to try and get both sides of this argument on. We will give people freedom of speech. We won't shut them up unless they're doing something which is encouraging criminality. And that was a change that, you know, I saw happening back then. And it seems to me we've now got a completely different model that you and I grew up with, maybe in the 1960s and 70s, to become a kind of almost like using the news bulletins as corporate advertising, disguising the corporate advertising in the news bulletins now. The journalists are not independent at all. Any journalists that are independent seem to be sacked.
Yeah, and of course, you know, if you look at the smearing as well, I'm sure that your smear, Tony, I haven't looked up a sort of, whether you're on Wikipedia or anything like that, but I know that there's lots of sort of journalists that are heavily smeared. The one that's in Bristol that does Palestinian things, Jonathan Cook. Mm. I've seen smearing of his report. I've seen smearing of sort of American journalists like Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger, and also smearing of sort of organisations like the World Council for Health, which doesn't state that it's a medical organisation. It states that it's an organisation that aims to improve health overall, which is sort of like a different thing because they're looking at lifestyle, diet, you know.
This is something that goes very deep, isn't it? I mean, my experience in 2008 with the National Union of Journalists was Paul Breeden and Christina Zaba within the Journalists Union, who took over from me because I was the branch secretary. They then did a hatchet job on me, smearing me as somebody who was anti-Semitic, homophobic, insane, a supporter of David Icke, and they tried to get me booted out of the union. So this is a pretty systematic approach, which makes me think this is, again, it's all premeditated, that this is leading up to the sorts of things like the genocide that we've seen.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And the thing is, what newspapers call it genocide? They don't even call it genocide in many newspapers. I think that The Guardian has recently, in the last month or so, started to mention genocide. And I think that the Telegraph has too. But I think that lots of newspapers, they haven't even used the word genocide, and the BBC has just been absolutely appalling.
Well, I'm not so sure. I was listening to Jeremy Bowen, and he was saying that, you know, this conflict goes back 100 years, things like that yesterday. And Rafi Berg, who is a very friendly with the CIA, he's worked for one of their front organisations. He's now the Middle East editor for online BBC. So there's almost like this battle is going on in the newsrooms now.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It would be quite interesting to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, and also to have a debate between Raffi Berg and Jeremy Bowen. I think that would be quite good fun. Anyway, look, just on the fact-checking, back to Trump and Zuckerberg and fact-checking, one of the stories we've seen over the last couple of weeks is these massive fires going on over in Los Angeles. There's a whole tug of war going on there, Judith, between people who say, well, actually, the infrastructure has been destroyed and sabotaged over the last 5, 6, 7 years. With the water resources destroyed, with the fire department having 100 or so of their fire trucks sitting there needing repair because they don't work and the money's been cut for them, versus people saying this is all being caused by the climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there's a reservoir that was used for firefighting that's been drained. Why? You know, it just seems like totally illogical. And then, of course, they put out, from what I read, they put out an alert on the 2nd of January saying that because of the fires, also there's these the homeless people that live around cities seem to like starting fires. 50% of the fires in the Los Angeles area in the last few years have been caused by homeless people. I don't know whether they set them purposefully or whether they set them in order to keep themselves warm or to cook food or whatever. But but a lot of fires are started by homeless people, and apparently when this alert goes out to say there's a severe risk of fire because when there are heavy winds, the trees blow against sort of electricity lines and sort of cause fires. And so with this risk, what should have happened was that helicopters should have gone out looking for fires, and they also should have called in for help from sort of like neighboring counties, from other fire departments, which they didn't do. And then the mayor, of course, I went off to Ghana and was not doing anything after a couple of days. And of course, the fires are then taking hold. So I think that, of course, they're trying to do everything to sort of like blame things on sort of like the agendas in order to win over public opinion for climate issues. So I've also heard that what they wanted to do was to refashion, you know, to actually build new cities, and the only way to sort of build them was to sort of like burn down what was already there, so that they could then build their new super cities.
Another thing is a lot of the residents in Los Angeles have said that there was something very strange happened with the insurance companies last summer and autumn, where they were refusing to renew insurance policies at the same time as the fire department were doing these cuts, and so the insurance companies seem to have been onto the problem. And that's one of the reasons so many people really do have lost their everything, because they couldn't afford these massive new hikes in their insurance policies taking place. Let's wind up, Judith, by looking again at this whole business of Trump. What do you make of what his influence will be in the Middle East, for good or bad? And also, I quite liked it when he was at a press conference and he would shout at somebody, say, "You're fake news," "Hey, it's the fake news," "No, I'm not talking to fake news." This sort of thing, which is what should happen, which is where our elected representatives. I mean, I'm no fan of Trump, but I like to see a politician who's not scared to face down the press.
Absolutely. Well, I'm not a fan of Trump. I don't like him at all. And yet I would have probably voted for him had I been in America, because I just feel that the alternative was just so dreadful and dangerous, and it had such a terrible record. Of course, people say that he doesn't like war and that that there weren't any wars during his last term in office. I think that that he does sort of like manipulate and cause some friction. So I'm not sure. I'm not saying that it's all is wonderful with him, but I think the world's at such a dangerous pace, Tony, and I just feel that if Harris had been voted in, it would have been more of the same. You vote Trump in, and maybe he may change something, or maybe he might not change something. But I think that it's worth trying voting for somebody that isn't part of the establishment, just to see what will happen. And wouldn't it be wonderful if he did make peace with Russia and the Ukraine war was ended and he sort of stabilised the Middle East in some way. Of course, people keep, it seems as if Iran now is the focus of Israel. I don't know whether Trump will want to attack Iran. Iran, of course, has got powerful allies to, in as much as it's got Russia and China and definitely have defence agreements with
Iran.
Well,
I mean, I think Iran is actually quite isolated. The Russians have pulled out of Syria pretty much.
Yes.
And the Chinese are thousands and thousands of miles away. So it almost seems as if they've been sort of isolated. I wonder whether you think Trump is going to really push for this battle in the Middle East against to try and wipe out Iran.
Well, it will be interesting to see. I wouldn't make a sort of a case either way. I'm just sitting here sort of hoping that somebody somewhere will see that American policy hasn't been in American interest. I mean, what you can see is that they have destroyed all the countries that were supported Israel. You've got Libya under Gaddafi. You've got Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Lebanon and Syria. You know, all of these countries that supported Israel supported Palestine have just all been wiped out.
Well, yeah, Egypt, if you go further back as well.
Well, of course, Egypt has been bought. I mean, it's given so much money that it can't exist without that money, and it complies with America's will. And of course, Jordan, right from 1948, when the Arab countries joined together to fight the colonization of Palestine, Jordan didn't. Jordan, in effect, was part of the support of the Zionists. And if it hadn't been, the chances are that the Zionists wouldn't have been able to get a colonialist foothold in Palestine, and Jordan has been ever since. I mean, for example, it was when the Iranians were sending bombs to Israel, Jordan was actually shooting down some of those missiles. So Jordan unequivocally is part of the West and has been since Israel has existed. But I don't think that necessarily makes it safe, because it's got over 50% of its population is of Palestinian origin, and if it doesn't toe the line, or if Israel greedily looks at Jordan and thinks that it would like to be part of Greater Israel, of course. On the Israeli flag, you've got these two rivers and the Star of David in between, and people say that's the Nile and the Euphrates, and that's the area of Greater Israel. It'll be quite interesting to see what actually happens, but I think that we're in for interesting times. I wouldn't say that I have confidence in Trump. But what I do have is hope in Trump, and that's a sort of like a bit different, if you know what I mean.
No, I do. Yes, of course. I think many people, you know, there's been lots and lots of criticism of him, particularly by the sort of liberal, neoliberal types in the West, saying this guy's a lunatic, an idiot. I mean, it certainly seems as if he's doing what he can to stop these various wars, and it wouldn't look very good if under Trump the US did start a massive war with Iran. That wouldn't look at all good from his point of view. You know, history would not be kind to him. But some people have been raising this whole business, Judith, of the Crusades and this whole idea of Israel being a sort of 20th century version of what was going on in the 12th century. Did you find people in the Middle East, and what do you think of that, comparing this sort of sending these medieval knights from Europe over to the Holy Land to then get booted out? Is something similar to happening today with the Israeli state, almost like a second bite of the cherry?
Well, I think that's the first time I've heard that said, maybe, but I mean, of course, the British who wrote the Balfour Agreement decided that it would be in their interests to have a Western colonialist settlement in Palestine. And so yes, it does have its origins from the British Empire. And then I think that some people think that the British Empire is still pretty pretty good at manipulating other powers in the world in order to do things that they would like, that they would like the British would like to do if they were more powerful. So yes, it's quite interesting, isn't it? But certainly the current British government, honestly, Tony, is it socialist? No, it's not, is it?
Not at all. Anyway, so it sounds to me like your verdict is we might have a war in the Middle East. We might even have a World War III, but at least it won't be fact-checked and we can watch it on Facebook.
It may be fact-checked, Tony. I think that a lot of the censorship on social media is going to change, particularly in America, but I don't think it's necessarily going to change in Europe. We'll have to see. You see, Zuckerberg has said that he's going to remove fact checkers in America by I think by March, by the end of March, but he hasn't said when he's going to remove the fact checkers in Europe. And as I say, at the moment he's negotiating, Meta are negotiating with the EU. And it may be that they keep some sort of fact-checking system, calling them community notes, but still employing fact-checkers in Europe. We have to sort of like wait and see.
Well, maybe the Americans will be able to watch it, but we won't.
Maybe, yeah.
All right, Judith Brown, can you just tell us whereabouts people can follow you, find you, your writings and your research?
Yes, you can follow me on Substack. I've got a Substack called The Control of Information, in which I look at different forms of censorship. I've been concentrating on fact-checking, which, of course, now hopefully will undergo some sort of change, and I shall keep an eye on that. And it's free, so I welcome new subscribers, and thank you, Tony, for giving me the chance to speak on your program.
Well, that's what we're here for. All right, Dr. Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.